Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Let me introduce you to Sirette Scott, actress, director, playwright, cultural historian. Her decades-long career has been a rich and rewarding one. It began in the early 70s when she got her first leading role in the play My Sister, My Sister, and wound up winning the prestigious Drama Desk Award. Sirette was also part of the Broadway cast of Entozaki Shange's mega hit for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. She's been in several movies, including Pretty Baby, Losing Ground. Made in 1982, it is one of the first feature films written and directed by a black woman that explores women's sexuality and modern marriage. It was recently resurrected to absolutely rave reviews. Sirette's acting career also includes the small screen, with roles in TV shows like Cosby and Miami Vice. And then there's her work as a director, and boy, is that list endless. It includes Off-Broadway, the Old Globe in San Diego, the Court Theater in Chicago, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the George Street Playhouse in New Jersey, where she recently directed The Whipping Boy, the powerful play about the Civil War featuring an all-male cast. She's directed new play workshops for the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, New York Stage and Film, Roundabout. Sirette, the author, wrote Second Line, produced by New Jersey's Passage Theater and the Atlas Theater in D.C., and Funny Time, a 10-minute play produced by the Public Theater and Negro Ensemble Company. She also conceived and directed the National Black Theater Communication Arts Program, Insight Second Sight, which celebrates the legacy of veteran actresses 50 years and older. Despite their contributions, their work has not been spotlighted. So now let's have the spotlight shine on Sirette, clearly a woman of many talents. So welcome and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Did you always want to be in the theater?
I always wanted to be in the theater. The story goes from my parents that as a very young girl, 4 years old actually, I would write in real large block letters my plays. Or I would just develop them just in, you know, myself. And I would write these plays, and they would be, somewhere between three minutes and 4 minutes long. And I even had a costume change.
Isn't that great? Why did you think of them as plays as opposed to stories as a four-year-old?
Because my father especially, both my parents were very interested in theater. So from a really young age, they would take me to myself and my sister to see anything that was around. Now, I grew up under segregation, and let's just put that on the table so you understand. Mm-hmm. But so we weren't allowed to go to a lot of the places. I grew up in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
So we weren't allowed into certain places, theaters and other venues, except for on certain days or that kind of thing. So my parents were not, they weren't having that. So
uh-huh.
We spent a lot of time at Howard University's theater department. They had plays all the time, and they would take me up there to see them. My father was really interested in live theater. He just loved it. It wasn't something that he grew up with. He grew up in North Carolina and, you know, migrated to Washington, D.C. But he was just really interested in theater. So my father would hear about a play in New York, and he would drive his cab, because he drove a taxi. He would drive his cab to New York, and he would see the play.
Get out.
And then he would drive back, and he'd tell my mother what the play was about, and then she would maybe come up the next week on a bus or something to see that play. And
that is just wild.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, in New York, you could just go to see
any. Of course, sure.
And it's interesting that in the nation's capital, you would have that much segregation going on. But
sure.
It was, that was what it was. And when we would go see the plays, there's a thing called booster seat now. There was nothing like that then. And so I remember sitting on coats and stuff. But I just was enthralled. I was just enthralled. I was just enthralled.
And so it wasn't that he was necessarily taking you to see, I'm just going to pull something out of there, like Peter Pan. You were seeing dramas?
I think I was seeing mostly musicals.
Musicals, okay.
And, you know, music and people dancing around and, and bright lights and all. So I don't remember anything. I don't remember anything but the lights, the music, people singing and moving and dancing. I just thought, really? This is the greatest thing that's ever
Isn't
happened.
Isn't that wonderful that you were exposed to that at such a young age? Was this a fantasy of theirs?
My mom, I think, just was, this is, I love theater, or I, you know, I enjoy all of this. I don't think my father thought of being something like an actor. I think the understanding of that world, that you could go somewhere in the world that would not be anything like what was happening in your
transport
own world.
Transport you.
Yes, yes. I think that that was of great interest to him. And he would write songs and sing them badly. And he and my mother were very supportive of all of my theater ideas. So when I wrote, I would write these plays, and then at dinner, my mother, father, and sister would sit there after dinner while I did my play after dinner. And like I said, they were about six at that age. When I was really little, they were like 2-3 minutes
sure.
long. And then they got to be about 6 minutes long. Still had an intermission. And sometimes a costume change because I made costumes as well. And then I started to incorporate my good buddies into my plays. I wrote all the plays, and Mary and Lena were my two good buddies. So I put them in my plays, and we did them on the back porch of our house. And some of the neighbors would pay 7 cents. Yes.
Isn't that fabulous?
They would pay 7 cents, and they'd come, and they'd sit on the back porch and see these plays that were now between 7 and 8 minutes.
So you were pretty prolific.
Yeah.
Okay, so not only were you writing plays, but you were directing Mary and Lena
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you starred in your own plays, right?
Yes.
You directed them. You wrote them. My goodness. Meet Sarette, the Renaissance child.
It was, of course, you never think you're doing anything different or unusual. It just...
It seemed very natural to you,
Oh, absolutely. And actually to Lena and Mary, after a while, well, why not? We're going to do some plays on the back porch. So we did. And sometimes I made their costumes. Sometimes, most of the time, they made their own. But the costumes, let me just say, were made out of that stuff called crepe paper.
Do
they even make that stuff anymore?
I think they do. I think you can still drape it along, you know, somewhere.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And it was held together with scotch tape. And, you know, occasionally we would have the scotch tape mishap while we were doing the show, but whatever.
But when you were going to school and when you weren't writing your own plays and starring in them, were you cast in plays in school?
Yes. In high school, I was in the drama department. I also danced for many years, and then I was involved with an organization called the American Light Opera Company which, in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
They did musicals, actually. Now, you have to understand, at that time, it was just not cool to be involved, or even light theater, or dance and all.
What was that, in the 60s?
Early 60s.
Yeah, I think we're contemporary.
Yeah.
So that was, okay.
Late 50s, yeah. Early 60s, yeah.
Uh-huh, and it was just when everybody else was just doing more frivolous stuff?
Yeah. It's just that nobody thought of the arts in any way.
Or held them in such high esteem.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't tell people when I was in junior high and high school that I was taking dance classes or that I was taking drama classes.
So where'd you go to college?
The first school I went to right after high school was North Carolina College in Durham, North Carolina. And I was there for a year. And I was in their theater and history department. History is also something that's very interesting to me. And while I was there, a flyer came saying that they were starting a new conservatory type of school at New York University. And they were going to be coming through to audition. And or if you couldn't make the auditions when they came through, that around the Easter holiday of that year, that you could come to New York and audition. So I applied, and they had missed the audition, so I had my mother and I drove to New York at Easter that year for me to audition for NYU, which it was called the School of Arts at that time. Now it's called Tisch. So the first year of it was when I auditioned and I was accepted. And I left North Carolina after that 1 year and came to New York to NYU Tisch. Well, NYU School of the Arts.
Sure, sure, sure.
And I was there for 2.5 years. Let me see. 3 years. And was having a great time. I had a lot of interesting things happen because it was the 60s. And, as I say in a lot of the press stuff, we had so many things going on that we could become involved with or we could walk away from. And we had civil rights, Vietnam, women's lib.
Right, right.
And the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Sure.
That was all a part of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So NYU, I tell people, sometimes there was no point in going to class because your professor was on the picket line for something. and it was that kind of thing. So in 1969, actually late 1968, a fellow student who had been involved with the civil rights movement early in the 60s, and he was now a grad student, and I was undergrad. His name was Gilbert Moses, and he was now at NYU. And I really looked up to him because he just seemed so driven, and he was an activist and all. And he had started an organization called the Free Southern Theater.
I was going to ask you about that,
yes.
The organization used drama to educate people about voter registration and integration and workers' rights. What a wonderful marriage that must have been.
It was a seminal moment in my life. And everything I did after or I have been about afterwards is reflected from that. We had a tiny little storefront office in New Orleans, and we had two station wagons and a smallish van, and we would go out to Mississippi and other parts of Louisiana, the more rural parts, and we'd set up our stage, depended on who had either invited us or what part of the state we were going. So if we were invited, it would be by some generally very small community center or maybe a church.
Mm-hmm.
And or if it was not that, then we would be set up right in somebody's backyard who let us set up, or in a cotton field.
Wow.
And it was just a platform. There were some platforms that we hooked together.
You brought theater to people who probably
absolutely
would never know from theater.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
How great is that?
They would sit there. We would do a piece or, and at the end of it, they'd sit there and they would wait for it to start again. They just waited for it to start.
Right, right, right.
Or sometimes there was one wonderful moment where there is a play I was in with, it was a two-character. Usually we didn't do two-character plays, but it was a two-character in this moment. And it was about, the play in the metaphorical sense was about waiting for something to
mm-hmm.
happen,
mm-hmm.
And having all of the things that you need right there, but not knowing how to use them. And in this case, the wife, me, I was trying to open a jar, and I can't get the jar open. And my husband is saying things about being able to get this open, and I just need to wait for it to happen, and just using that as a way of talking about civil rights or segregation or something. And so I'm not supposed to get the jar open. It was like 7 pages of dialogue. And this very nice gentleman just gets up.
And, from the audience?
Yeah. And he comes up on stage and he takes the jar.
And he opens it for you.
Yes, he does. And he hands it back to me. And, you know, he says, you know, I didn't want you to stop, you know, because you couldn't get it. So it was just that kind of thing that would happen. It was just wonderful.
Then you make the transition to New York City theater. Do you think your seminal moment, was it My Sister, or For Colored Girls?
Actually, no. What happened, we did a play in the Free Sun Theater. We did a play called Slave Ship, written by then Leroy Jones, now Amir Baraka.
Right.
And that play we were doing down there on no money, no budget really, but it was extremely controversial and it was extremely well done. Chelsea Theater Center from BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, one of the producers came down and saw it and said, this is incredible. They brought that production, not that exact production, because we had no money doing it there, but they decided they wanted to do it at the Chelsea Theater Center in Brooklyn. And it was an off-Broadway production that was extraordinary and extremely controversial at the time. And from there, they sent us to Italy, France, and Switzerland.
Wow, wow.
And that started from the Free Southern Theater.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. So when I came back to New York from that, that's when I was looking to find work as an actress without all of the sort of activist end of it.
I understand.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Sarette Scott, who is an actress, a director, a playwright, as well as a cultural historian. I'm curious, Sarette, was it difficult for you to get acting jobs based on who you are? Even in 2015, you just sort of still hear the laments of there's not enough good roles for African-American women or just for women, whatever. I mean, was it... What was that like back then?
Well, yes and no. And one of the things, I do feel like I hit the professional end of it just at the cusp of something where either it was going to go one way or the other. And in my case, it went for me in the direction I wanted it to go. There were not many roles. And that was the reason why so many black theaters were saying, we can't work anywhere. We will start our own companies. We will do our own work. The problem was that they didn't have as much funding as some of the white companies,
sure.
But the white companies weren't doing black plays.
Sure, right.
So a lot of great theater, black theater, developed during that time, and I was able to get work within those companies. And, you know, of course, we all know the Negro Ensemble Company, and we know New Lafayette, and... Oh, New Heritage, and just...
And on and on.
On and on. They were just great theaters. And since I was able to work in some of those, the same thing that happens now is you sort of network without... That word wasn't around, I don't think, but... So I met people who would say, look, so-and-so is doing a show. So that's actually how My Sister came along, is that I was doing a play with... several actors from the Negro Ensemble. And one of the actors said to me, oh, a friend of mine just sent me a script and said that he wrote it and he wanted to know if I knew anybody who would work well as this young girl in the play. And since we were doing this, I thought about you. He said, as a matter of fact, I read it and that's all I thought about because it just seemed right for you. I will let you know, he says, when they're going to do the play. And about 7 months later, I got a call from my friend, Arthur French was his name, and he said that he had gotten a call and that they're auditioning people for the play. And I tried to get into the audition before I knew anything about Arthur mentioning me. And I finally got in, and it was wonderful. I got the role. It was a young girl. The lead character was a young girl who had been sexually abused, and it had caused her to develop several personalities.
Uh-huh.
And that was hence My Sister. She was herself. She was her sister. She was many people.
So that was kind of a seminal moment for you. I mean, clearly when you win an award like that, you know, that, I mean, and that's an amazing validation, too.
Yeah.
You know, not that one always needs an award for that, but, I mean, you knew that there was, like, a great marriage for you.
Absolutely.
You know, a good role. I'm just really curious, how does one make the transition, and why, from acting to directing?
Well, the why is easier. And that it was simply a mistake.
Oh.
I don't mean it in a negative sense.
No.
It was just literally I was crossing the street in the rain, and I saw two people on the other side of the street looking at me, and I said, oh, I'm doing a play. They're going to stop me and say, hi, Sir Red Scott.
Oh, yes. They recognize me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it was off-Broadway, and, you know, you often get stopped on the street. And so they stopped me and said, hi, you're Sir Red Scott. I said, yeah. And then they said, you want to direct a play.
Oh, come on, Sir Red.
That's what I said, excuse me? And they said, no, do you want to direct a play? We have a play that
Were they stalking you, or they just
No, they just saw. They were standing there when I crossed the street.
Okay.
They said the play was about a young black girl who was the victim of incest. And they wanted a black woman director. And they said at that time that they just didn't know any black women directors. And I knew at least two or more, actually. And I mentioned their names, and they said, well, do you want to do it? And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You call the playwright. You tell the playwright you saw me on the street corner in the rain, and I have never directed a play.
Yeah,
If he says yes, I'll do it. He said yes. So I did it. And
and you loved it?
No, I did it in thinking, well, this was a real interesting thing. That
experience.
Yeah, and that let's just move on. And what happened was I sent a flyer about the play to a friend of mine who was a playwright. And I said, look, Nancy Fells Garrett was her name and is her name. And I said, look, Nancy, someone talked me into directing a play. Isn't this great? Well, Nancy's new play, she was a playwright, had just been accepted at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven.
In New Haven. Mm-hmm.
And so she takes the flyer in and says, look, Soretta's directing now. And they said, well, Soretta works as an actress up here. And they said, well, she's directing. So they call me in for an interview. I could not believe it. They call me in for an interview. And at the end of the interview, they said, we're going to make you an offer. In which case, the air left the room because that was what happened.
Is this what you prefer to do?
Well,
I mean, you've directed so many things.
You know, what happened with it was that once I did that play at the Long Wharf, and, you know, back then reviews were in the newspaper and everybody read the paper instead of looking online. But,
right.
And so the reviews were really good. And I got so much attention and interest immediately, so that by
is
the
that
time,
because of who you were? African American woman.
I think that was part of it, but also that I had already done enough in the theater to be validated
to
in
have
that
street
way.
Cred.
Yeah, exactly. And so between the two of those things, I just feel very much like that was how it all sort of opened up and
but
developed.
You still have to concede in today's times that you're still an anomaly. I mean, maybe there are more women directors, but come on. When you spread it all out, you know, there's just a few over, you know, there's a few over here, and it's, you know, it's a male-dominated field.
It is a male-dominated field. And there are at least 10 times more than when I came in because there were, you know, there were what? The difference, I think sometimes that you have to make it, sometimes what was going on was that you find women locally, meaning if I lived in Cleveland, I could work at some of the smaller
regional theaters there, you mean?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Cleveland, but
okay.
not anywhere else. Where what happened with me was that I managed immediately to be national. So I was... my second show after New Haven was New Mexico, then Atlanta, and so I
It was almost a natural progression for
you. It was. And it was, and I think that that was the reason why once it started happening, I felt like I couldn't look this in the face and move away. Meaning when I got offers for acting jobs, I would always take the directing job because so many people were trying to open that door. And I felt like if the door was opening for me, I needed to go on through it so that somebody can come in behind me.
Gotcha.
And if I were just to limit myself to the acting, even though some of the projects that were coming at me were really interesting, I just thought I really need to keep this little crack in the door open, not only for myself so I can work at all these different things. That's why I have a national resume,
yeah,
and regionally, and but that's kind of what I was feeling, and I,
so it was kind of a higher calling, and you're not full of yourself. It had to go beyond you.
I knew that it wasn't going to necessarily open for the person behind me, but if it was already a little open, mm-hmm. they would have more of a chance of getting
that
it. And
get
I don't
through.
Know that I was thinking that consciously. I really don't think I was thinking consciously, but I just knew that I had to follow through on the directing because it was coming at me fast and furious, and it was coming from all over the country. So I was saying, I have to do this. And then young people, women, would come up to me and say, so-and-so is going to give me an interview, or may I be your assistant director or something. And just that was what had to happen at that time.
I'm curious, in the play The Whipping Boy, it's an all-male cast. How'd that go?
In my career as a director, I have often been, I would say 2/3 of the plays I've directed were all male or heavily male.
Wow.
Now, part of that has to do with what's being written.
Sure.
But also there, I don't know, just early on, I just always got offers from things that had lots of male characters in them. And I remember one review from a national paper that said, looking at Miss Scott's work, you would not know she was a woman.
And is that a steel hand in a velvet glove?
Yeah, that really was it. They were saying she directs with a...
She directs like a man?
Yeah, she directs with a sort of masculine energy, which is why I think I, always ended up working with so many men in productions. And
Who took you seriously, by the way?
Yeah, most of the time. If I have had some people who, men who weren't crazy about the fact that.
Well, you find jerks everywhere. Yeah. What's in the future for you?
Well, I have a couple of projects that I myself am developing that for me are really, really exciting. And I have to admit, at this point, after years of acting and directing and writing, I do want to do some things that maybe a little off the rails.
Grid.
Yeah. So I'm one of the things I'm developing is what you mentioned about women of a certain age and their stories.
Yes.
We already had one, and it was so well received with people wanting to know more about the life, the understanding of the art at a certain time and place. That is one of the things that I'm really, really interested in. And there's another project that I can't talk about yet.
Well, that you'll certainly give us a heads up about, I hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sarette, sometimes it just stuns me when the time is, it just goes so fast. You're so engaging and there's so much to say. And how great for you to look back and feel really proud of a very eclectic career.
Yeah. When you're in it, you don't think about any of that.
I'm sure.
You just sort of are doing it. And then you look back and say, oh, I did this. Oh, I did that. Or I met this person that is now iconic in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent some time, just talking or something. And it was just amazing to me.
So you have to feel good about where you are today.
I do.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was really a pleasure to meet you and get to know you.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed being here, and I thought about things I haven't thought about in years.
That's excellent, then.
Okay.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.